where you
so
might start to become more expectant.
Coming from what is something that Maxime said during his introductory speech, because of naturalness, things want to be heavy.
Uh-huh.
That means they want to oscillate. So these shifts look for constant drifts, meaning that the mass of the particle that causes the shift is lighter than Hubble, which is 10 to the minus 33 eV. I mean, it's a tiny number.
Mm-hmm.
But the most natural thing is to move at higher frequencies. The higher, the better. So that can happen easily. Well, yeah. So, I mean, you want to say something?
Yeah, I want to say that much of the, PR stuff about the changing couplings and how it comes sort of the most naturally from
mm-hmm.
string theory. This thing over pushed to the extreme, right? So I have colleagues in astrophysics that test for alpha, and she thinks she tests in string theory. Talk to any string theorist, and they would say, our job here on the theory part is to not make some huge overstatements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that if you have a light field that somehow couples to F mu squared of electromagnetism and renormalizes the value of the coupling, it is very hard to make it really light as with a mass similar to the Hubble scale now, so that it keeps rolling, right? So the heavier the mass is actually the more natural the field would be. And in particular, if you can think of some massive field, I'll do this and answer, right? Let me say this. Alpha of t is alpha of 0 plus some delta alpha, some sine omega t, right? That's a two-parameter answer here, right? And if I take omega really tiny, this will correspond to a linear drift, right? So if I plot it this way and put somewhere like a mark of H equals 10 minus 40 UGV or whatever, it's a Hubble scale. Now, this direction this way would be less and less natural.
You're putting down increasing.
This is more natural.
Meaning this is larger periods, larger frequencies.
This is
opposite way.
T is 1 over omega, and this is
inverse.
This is T equals the inverse of this, which guess what is 13 million years. yes, it is. Yeah.
What's the expectation of?
I would say that for me the more natural story would be an oscillating coupling with some, if they've got to change at all, right? That it would be more of the oscillations with some, you know. Say I take one hertz frequency, that will be 10 minus 15 electron volts, right? If I approach it with the mindset of fine-tuning, right, I would have to fine-tune this model, but I would have to fine-tune it much less than 10 to the minus 33 electron
volts.
But
isn't there like this 10 to the 12 hertz?
That's a great frequency. Exactly right. This is a fantastic point.
So
10 to the 12, one terahertz, because it corresponds to the nearest millimeter.
Yeah.
So this is a great, so this is the usual, so when you write
This is a frequency for the change of topic.
Yeah, yeah,
not
so
the
you say that the
light,
natural
right?
frequency,
yes, yes, yes,
and this is
yeah.
a great number, and
yeah.
the reason people mention this number is because, so let's say you write a pattern that goes like pi over a plug times f mu squared, for example. Okay? So calculate the corrections to the mass of this particle, putting the cutoff at where we expect because of naturals at the TEV.
Mm-hmm.
You find that the m squared because of loop corrections, yeah, if you put the cutoff at the TEV, goes like TEV squared m, goes like TEV squared over m Planck, times the loop factor, and you find this is a millimeter, which corresponds to the photons. And this is the problem of the tuning. So you can make the pattern smaller,
mm-hmm.
but then you embed the mass goes down. But then, so the question is,
so basically what you are saying, like kind of most naturally,
yes.
these frequencies should actually be pretty fast.
Yes, yes, this is actually correct.
So maybe
correct.
What is, maybe this is all we're just looking in a
wrong,
no,
way,
no,
the wrong
you,
way,
yes,
right?
Yes,
why
this is
why
absolutely
true.
Just
to not to get too hard on our colleagues, check this.
No, but no, but you should tell us. That's your chance to tell us where we should be looking, right?
Look,
no,
we
should
have
go.
We
should address problems.
We have, of course, the LSC colleagues with the idea.
We are not
as
we are not
with some ideas of naturalness in mind, and we did not succeed all that well.
Nature, for example, axioms. That could have this type of couplings, like scalar couplings, that where the cutoff, because of composites, for example, take the QCD axiom. When you calculate corrections to the loop, to the mass of the axiom, everything is cut off at the TV scale. So for that particle in particular, now we can discuss what the actual coefficient is here and how it couples to us, which turns out is very suppressed. You can find that this cutoff here, this naive cutoff, could be the QCD scale. You could imagine technical natural crazy theory where this is just the electron mass. Because this is. So there are ways to make this number overall smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But the axiom doesn't lead to a life change of
coupling. No, that's true. Because the coupling is very suppressed. Because CP violation, the standard in we have constraints with the amount of CP violation, which is very small.
I of course, I agree. Having the slow variation of couplings is probably horribly unnatural for these reasons. But one thing I've never thought carefully about, I mean, to take a page out of your book, I've never thought carefully about it. Maybe you have, or maybe someone has. Maybe it doesn't work. You can't have a slow continual variation because that means of a scalar, of a constant, as you know very well, that is a scalar field by definition that is changing slowly in time, so has a light mass.
Yeah.
But you could have a single discrete event. You could
that's
have a phase
right.
transition.
That's right. That's
that at
right.
least
yeah,
wouldn't
that's,
be unnaturalized. Do you know how people
that,
make such
that's
models?
That's right. It could be, could be also domains with different boundaries.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's
a reason to search to Z of 5.
Right, right.
9.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the, speculative explanations to this Australian dipole.
Okay.
It's not by, a constant line, but rather a step through, right? Because you can
exactly.
put a step through this, right?
I mean, that's the extent to which...
That's as good as an explanation as a dipole, or maybe better, right? Because,
exactly.
The problem of naturalness will be linked to the inverse width of this
it seems
stem,
much better,
right?
Yeah.
And it will be better.
And that's also the extent to which laboratory experiments then don't constrain, right?
But
normally you can translate a laboratory experiment to a bound and a linear variation, you can compare them to astrophysical things. There you lose completely. Laboratory experiments can't measure such.
I just wanted to get back to this plane, and before we sort of convince ourselves that 99.9% of it is not worth thinking.
But look, I mean, it's at the same time, what I'm trying to say is maybe if it's really, we should be looking at like 10 to 12 hertz.
That's right.
I mean, it's
yeah.
good to know that because maybe.
Right, right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just,
I mean, it's
yeah.
not like it doesn't. The fact that people are not doing it does not mean that.
No,
yeah,
that
yeah,
it's
like
it.
A higher repetition rate, not
this
experiment. Higher repetition rate.
So, this is. This direction is less natural, this direction of more natural, right? So, yes, there is an expectation from this analog. But I wanted to say that, in this time scale of variation here, right, we could have sort of different benchmarks, sort of, if it's longer than 1 year or 10 years, it will be conceptually the very same, but you know, when we test for, you know, alpha dot over alpha, right, which remains more or less constant on the scale of tests that are done, right? But so the over here would be tests that are similar to what was done now, right? But there can be situations, say, 1 second, right, where it's becoming comparable to the time scale which many you know, clocks operate, and that's something gotta change, right? And you know, pushing back here, you get to 10 minus 15 seconds or so. That's really hard direction, but it sets some parameter space, right? Which I would like to understand where the sensitivity lies, right? So there's delta alpha here and omega on that scale, and that's.
By the way, Peter, can I make a comment? Because you said about domain walls, public domain wall, one special feature. The width of the domain wall is set by the mass of the particle.
Yeah.
Right? So that requires still a very light particle.
No. I'm talking about a phase transition in the universe. This is not something you would see in a laboratory experiment. This would exactly be a place you cannot compare the astrophysical bounds to laboratory experiments. It would be why you look to Z of 0.9 or 5.2 or whatever to see, was it different in the early universe than today, right? It's something that can change from the early universe today, but you will not see it. There will be zero variation in any atomic box experiment today.
But there will be still light particles.
Yes, there's still light particles.
Because your phase transition is delayed.
That's what I was asking you. Have you tried to make such a model? I'm not sure. I'm not certain it has to be so light. With the rolling field today, it has to be less.
Quite nuclear kind of lifespan, or you know, like.
Because we still want a significant change of alpha, right? I would imagine that even, you can imagine that you have a phase. So the question is, can you imagine? You can have what you say, because you can have some sector that's dark, it's composite, so it's very big and fuzzy. And
I don't know.
I don't know.
Obvious to me.
Yes.
It's not necessarily even thermal equilibrium. It's not obvious to me that it has natural the same naturalness constraints at all. I just don't know if anyone's tried. I haven't tried. I mean, this just occurred to me.
Yeah.
But
the domain in space can work.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
that
domain
too.
In space,
that too.
But
exactly.
That requires light scale, right? Because the domain in space tells you that the width of the wall usually set by the mass of the particles.
No, but you don't care
about
the width of the space. If you have different values for the couplings on
the
other side.
But that the dipole of the Australians was very.
Oh, no, but you can put this to, you know.
Very delta function.
Right. Who knows, right?
Yeah.
No, I think it could be much more natural.
Yeah. Want to say something?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. By the way, Andre afterwards should take the stand because there's an announcement to make.
Yeah. Oh, first thing I wanted to say is that Andre pointed out earlier. Should I wear this? No.
Unless the voice of God says so.
For now, there's God is
Andre pointed out that at the demo meeting, there was a lot of discussion of dark matter. I was very pleasantly surprised by this. There were really at least 4 talks that mentioned dark matter at the atomic and molecular physics meeting, and that included also the public lecture, which was about the dark matter. That was very nice. And then Andre said that some people don't believe that dark matter exists, and that, and I think it's wonderful that they don't, because I think it's great not to take things for granted. And I think it's only there may be experts here will explain this later, but I think it's thanks God there is a bullet cluster that shows us that the dark matter can be separated from ordinary matter. Otherwise, I think it would have been really a very active topic of debate. Is that right?
But there are some other examples
yeah.
that go the other way. So, you know, you've got to be careful. There is this other, whatever number is, where the separation goes, you know, illogical from the point of the dark matter. So.
Hold on. I think it's extremely difficult to explain cosmic microwave background results without non-baryonic dark matter. Bullet cluster is very nice because you can make a picture. but the evidence that we have for non-baryonic dark matter today, the strongest evidence comes from the cosmic microwave background. And it's virtually inconceivable that you could come up with some other model without dark matter, with some Kakamame gravity that gives you CMB fluctuations exactly like those measured. So,
corroborated by that.
Well, I think Andre's point was probably mostly that people haven't heard about dark matter. That's bad, but
no, they just think, you know, this is something that these guys have come up with, and it's just a story, right? A nice story, but not there are no evidence.
It's not ultimate proof. You mean that?
But they understand the problem, the observational problem.
Well, I hope that we are making inroads in that community to spread the word. Yeah? So, anyway, it's a different community. Yeah?
Can I have that?
I don't know how. Can you put it to sleep and then turn it back on again?
I think maybe the projector.
It's working. It's on. Is that
it's
input
on,
one
yeah.
or two? It's on input one.
If you're
close it and open the computer.
Try unplugging it and then replug it in.
That's a good
idea. Okay, so I just wanted to talk just a little bit more about open questions, and there are some actually the questions I think somebody in this audience can address, but because it will have to do with the Casper experiment, even though it wasn't discussed yet, I just want to show you one plot. So Casper stands for Cosmic Axion Spin Precession Experiment, and this is something that was brought to life by the work of Peter and Surjit, and then Alex Sushkov and I and Michael had better help these guys to work out how the experiment might run.
Continue.
Anyway, There are two things that this Casper experiment is aiming to do, and one is to look for these electric dipole moment experiments. This should be actually a very depressing thing for people who have searched for dipole moments all their life, because the longer they integrated, some of them are here in the audience, the better they would average it to zero, because this is looking for a dipole moment that's oscillating at the axion mass frequency, which could be, say, from kilohertz to gigahertz or something like this here. Another effect it has nothing to do with EDMs. It's this derivative interaction that leads to this sort of quasi-magnetic field that's not a real magnetic field and cannot be also detected with magnetometer experiments. And this derivative interaction whose strength is shown here. This is mass. This is the definition. This is mass, and this is the strings, and there are some constraints that come from astrophysics, and this line corresponds to the QCD axion, and so there is a large parameter space, wide parameter space that's unconstrained here that we are hoping to constrain. There will be more about it, I hope, in the meeting, but I just wanted to say what this is about. And I'm going to go back to this other presentation here, and the first open question that I have here, that actually my theory colleagues do not really think it's a very important one, but as an experimentalist, I feel it is a very important question. Is we're talking about this quasi magnetic field, So we talk about these quasi-G factors for things. And by the way, this is something that I believe is the same for Casper and the wall crossing, because it has to do with, you know, with the derivative of the axiom field. And the question is, how would xenon and helium and rubidium nuclei respond relatively to this field?
You're not talking about EDM, just the regular coupling to the spin, right?
Yeah, it's derivative coupling. And I think this is important because one of the things we would like to look at is the, for example, a particular way helium and xenon respond to this, and if it is different from the magnetic perturbation, this would be a nice distinguishing feature for that. And by the way, I wanted to maybe show you something, which you also here. Let's see, let me go to the next slide. Sorry. So there's a whole talk that Professor Trams will present. I'm really looking forward to it on Casper. Now, so I think this is the terminology I'd like to introduce. So you saw the space of parameters, and this is a very challenging experiment. It'll take many years to constrain it. But one of the ideas we would like to put forward is that some of the limits could be obtained now by looking at the existing experiments and reanalyzing the existing data, and that's what Professor Trams will talk about, actually, and I like to call it Casper now. And similarly, I think the GNOME experiment also can have a GNOME now, basically something that can be obtained immediately. I visited PTB just a couple of weeks ago on the invitation of Professor Trams, and this building actually contains the best magnetically shielded rooms about which we'll hear also later. And inside of it, they have a very sensitive squid arrays that can monitor the free precession of nuclear spins in vapor cells, and they can monitor them for hours, and in days in the case of helium, and hours in the case of xenon. I picked it somewhere on the web. On the web page, I think you will have a better slide, but I just wanted to show this to ask my question. And my question is, so if we are to look at the signature that the GNOME experiment is looking for, so crossing of the domain wall, which is basically there is an event of some duration that's very short, a millisecond or something, or even faster, and it rotates the nuclear spins in this experiment by some angle. What is the optimal strategy to detect that? There are questions about the data analysis, so it will be just basically a very nice sine wave and then the phase discontinuity. And how do you don't know when it occurs, and so how you analyze that? And what also, how you bin your data if you have several hours of relaxation time, you know, how you, which chunks of time you use for this analysis. And experimentally, is it better to actually increase the density of the spins a lot and shorten the integration time, or long integration time is good? So these questions, I think that they're both experimental questions and analysis question about how to detect such an event.
There is no unique answer to the question, what is the G factor? Because you, in any model, you will have, say, coupling to up quark and down quark as a free parameter. So any of this, okay, if then take 10 spins, then of course there will be some relation, you know, 8 relations between them or so, but in principle, you have coupling to up to the quark spin and down quark spin, and you know.
If you turn around and say you're measuring those fundamental couplings, in fact, by measuring different.
And there's no reason why this would be the same as the ratio of the electromagnetic couplings, right?
Yeah,
that's the question that you want to know. And the,
well, exactly. I also want to know what the, this ratio is as well. Impossible. Maybe for some ratio.
Yeah, this is model dependent because it depends in principle what the charge of the up and down quark. You can imagine that the action comes from a PQ symmetry, so in principle it depends on the charges that the action has and the symmetry. So, as Eugene said, there is no relation between what the ratio of the magnetic moments is compared to the actual, let's call it G factor, to the coupling of the xenon, helium 3. In principle, there'd be, so they will be different.
Okay, so so I have this question also of weak axiom, because I heard you talk about a similar analysis for the weak interaction, and he's of an opinion that in fact that you can calculate this, but just can't extract the number from.
Yeah, you can calculate it, but you will recalculate them in terms of, you know, couplings to up quark and down quark, and maybe gluons, which will be, you know, free parameters, right? So you can relate things at the level of, you know, nuclear matrix elements, or what you call G factors, to the level of quarks, but just about that, right? I mean,
and it would make a relation from many different nuclei to just a small number,
right,
two or three fundamental physics parameters. So that is a relation width, or someone can calculate. But it would still be a free parameter space in terms of those fundamental parameters.
So how would you so suppose something is observed, how do you put it on that exclusion plot? Or suppose something is not observed, if you don't know these things, how are you going to put them on the exclusion plots? I mean, we should do better, I think one should do better than just another.
I mean, if you remember the various axion plots, QCD axions, right? There is like a band, right? So there are various, and within band, I guess any line is good enough, right?
Right.
And this takes into account model dependence, right?
So, but that happens to be very nicely a thin band, right? On that plot.
Well, that will be the same story here, right? I mean, unless you take, you know, some extreme cancellation. No,
exactly.
If there is no cancellation, they will all scale together. Right?
I think
people here calculated this too. Is it just? To me, at least, the simplest or the best you can do is, you know, you can easily relate all of these different moments to the proton and the neutron, the, like, nuclear shell model, or slight, you know, variations of the nuclear shell model. And then you can do parameter exclusion plots for proton couplings. I think that's the standard thing that most people do, proton couplings, neutron couplings, and electron couplings. And, you know, that's, you know, which, of course, then you can relate back to, at some level to, but, you know, I mean, the you know, I think that's, and so you can say some experiments are more sensitive to protons or neutrons, electrons, and that's, you know, that's where the orthogonality between different experiments comes. But I think that's,
so
to my taste, if we haven't discovered anything yet, that's probably good enough at this point. Right?
So can I identify some, major generic model or something where you can calculate this just
a little fun? Calculate for what? For a given action? I mean, for the QCD action, you can calculate them.
Well, I think those are various first approximations. Both helium and xenon, the valence nucleon is a neutron.
That's right.
And so from that level, you know, they will measure the same thing. And, you know, people who look for the Lenz violation, of course, you know, I did relate to this comparison. And I think Evan Maxim has calculated some, you know, very simple nuclear model that improves a little bit on that basic picture. Mm-hmm. Unless we do one has a full sort of shell model calculation, you could not do much better than that. In a full shell model, you probably will have some contribution from the problem as well. But at a very simple level, it will be just a neutron in both cases.
Okay. So the simplest question is, even if you assume variability, you know, coupling to up quarks and down quarks not exactly the same, that, you know, much of this as at least xenon and helium-3, that this, I think I know, that it's mostly coupled to valence neutron, right? As,
so I like that.
Mike is saying that everything is, in some sense, parameterizable by the coupling of the gradient of the axion field to the spin of the nucleon, right?
I like that very much, because that, it means that this effective g-factor is the same for helium and xenon, but magnetic g-factors are very different, right?
Well, that's the approximation people have used for Lorentz violation.
Right. It's the same story.
It should work here as well.
I like that. I mean, this is the answer to my question.
Yeah, but can I slightly, I mean, if you look for the magnetic signatures in your self-compensating magnetometer, are we right that we think that, for example, when the magnetic field is coming, whatever, a pulse of the magnetic field is coming, that there will be a very fast response of rubidium and much slower response of helium that will go to the equilibrium, back to the equilibrium. So you can say, for example, by comparing amplitude, you can say this is coupling from magnetic coupling, and this is something different because the ratio is different.
I mean, that's sort of a different topic, but in the common commutators, if you take the signal and you integrate whatever transient you get, any magnetic field response will give you a zero area under the transient. Like I've shown it a long time ago, and we'll talk about it a bit more. So if you basically take whatever wiggle you get and you find it, the integral is not zero, it's not okay.
Since we are running out of time, we can, you know, we'll have also the whole base devoted to magnetometry, right?
Okay.
So we can, I was wondering if anyone has anything to say about variations of couplings, atomic clocks would
I have one more question about atomic clocks, and then I'm back.
I would just like to point out one thing, that if we're doing these experiments, we have three co-magnetometers, actually, because we also have the squid.
Yeah.
And if there is some magnetic interference, we should, if provided it's strong enough, we should see it also by the squid. So this, I think, is a very strong argument to distinguish artifacts from
exotic
physics.
There might be a problem, I mean, I don't want to go into much detail into this, but it is possible that the shield itself may respond to the coupling and then generate a real magnetic field that would be seen by the squid. But we should talk about it a little more.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, it doesn't work. If the coupling is different than the magnetic coupling, then the shielding is incomplete.
But you will get signals of squid potential.
Yes,
well,
because
you
the urge.
Yeah. Let me just point out very quickly that for your second question, I don't think you actually need to excite the spins. I think if you just leave the point along the magnetic field, just wait for it to be tipped from this transient. So you don't really need to look at the transition.
Yeah.
But maybe yes, maybe no, because if we are to run this experiment in the parasitic regime, when they are doing some other experiments, then we need to know this answer. But it's a good point that maybe just
whether
you see
the also
a good idea.
So how about I try to connect atomic clock and magnetometer? First of all, you know that there is this quadratic Zeeman shift in clocks, right? So, and basically you have magnetic field and then some effective magnetic field which comes from axion field, for example, you could have these two effects combined together as a second order effect, right? And then it would get, it would give some sort of a second order effective Zeeman shift, which could be also sensitive to what you guys are looking for, okay? So.
Yeah.
And the other thing is probably
as soon as I heard about Andre and Maxim trying to in the case of Maxim take the gnome idea and go to clocks I was starting to wonder, is it the same or different? And at first Andre quickly explained to me that it's another portal. It's a different thing, but still, I was wondering whether connecting the two networks of clocks and magnetometers, somehow cross-referencing them would be great. And as Peter told me, anything should start with an acronym. So I thought of NOMAC, which is a global network of atomic magnetometers and clocks. So that's also a question. What can be learned from cross-correlating these things?
Okay, I have maybe a totally different subject, but maybe it's very, very naive question, kind of going back to what was being discussed earlier. So, I mean, I know this is all for a scalar field with a scalar coupling, but, you know, I think of another very light mass particle, the neutrino. Is that, does the neutrino's existence somehow violate naturalness? Or
No, the neutrino is a fermion.
Well, that's true. So fermions don't have a problem.
Fermions are protected by chiral symmetry, so, yeah. They're protected by symmetry, chirality, so it's natural that the neutrino is light.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's the great thing about neutrinos.
They also occur in nature, so.
That's
important. I didn't hear that.
Yeah,
of
course.
So that kind of symmetry doesn't exist
for
bosons?
At least for the couplings that were write down the explicitly. So there is the analog to the shift symmetry. And that's explicitly violated the moment you write this type of scalar coupling. So the moment you have this type of correction, then you have large corrections to the mass, at least naively. Maybe someone would come up with a model. As far as we understand, it's another hierarchy problem. You can think about it the same way. It's like the hierarchy problem for the Higgs.
I would still work on, you know, if I had been involved in any of these analyses on filling this plot, right, and then worry about naturalness later, right?
Yeah,
I mean that's a follow up question, right? Because it sounds like people kind of give a similar argument for, you know, the Higgs mass being what it is, but there's these same kind of arguments, right, that the Higgs mass should be pushed.
Yeah.
If there's nothing existing between the Higgs mass and the gut scale, then you got
there's
problem,
a slight
right?
difference. We haven't proved what it is between the TV scale and the gut scale.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Higgs particle, we could still, in principle, even though that may not work as well anymore, you can still have an argument that why it's light. You can go to the TV if the LHC discovers new particles in a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can argue that these are correlated with the lightness of the Higgs, and then this loop correction that you calculate are naturally cut off at the scale where the corrections to the Higgs mass are not important.
But about the constant, right? So that's another of these hierarchy problems that we have probed well beyond the scale of the cosmological constant, and Raman will tell us perhaps something about it tomorrow. But in general, I mean, that's an example of something where we have probed well beyond what the naturalness things should tell you, and we don't see any new physics there. Nothing really explains that quantity. Should you have gone ahead and measured the cosmological constant? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So.
So I think there is a consummation of nightmares in the sense that, I mean, if our worry is that tomorrow we're going to find super partners for the Higgs boson, and then the Higgs will be natural, and we're worried sick because that would undercut doing these experiments, we should really be celebrating. But given that we know that a lot of the particle theorists in the room are worried sick, frankly, they're even attending this workshop, because they're worried sick that they're not going to find super partners for the Higgs boson, then as soon as naturalness is being questioned in that context, we should question, I agree with Maxime, we should question whether we should use such a strong filter as this philosophical naturalist problem to really say it's not motivated to look at
a certain. The other thing is there is something, I don't think these analyses are very hard to do,
especially
for atomic clocks.
Exactly.
You need to repeat the measurement. So given the cost versus risk, given that it's not such a hard analysis to do, to look for AC effects, it's totally worth doing. Whether or not, if you find something, everyone will be surprised. There's going to be another hierarchy problem you have to explain. Maybe we don't have to worry about it, but that's something to keep in mind.
And I think for experimentalists...
We all agree.
For experimentalists, it's only worth knowing that somebody might accost you and say, hey, what you're looking at is not technically natural.
Yeah.
And the only thing is to get from the theorists here is the appropriate sense of, huh. It's only the confidence with which you say that.
So, if you take this seriously, then we should be looking for variation of alpha with a timescale of 10 to the minus 15 seconds. Then actually, it's not atomic physics that we need, but we need some other process where you know, the actual energy attraction.
I'm happy to look at it at log-log scale, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I know that there will be some exclusion, you know, line right now, right? And it's, and from different parts on this log-log scale, right? The information will come from different pieces of physics, for sure, right? And I'm just saying that this is, in the context of today's discussion, the most reasonable thing. In the context of changing coupling, to me, it's the most reasonable thing to do. And over here, there will be clearly atomic clocks. Maybe over here as well, how
yes.
far? I don't know. Right? That's
if you extrapolate, by the way, from current sensitivity, atomic clocks, and if you assume that particle is dark matter, if you assume that the particle that creates this variation is dark matter, you can get a prediction as a function of the coupling of how big the variation is. So it turns out atomic clocks can actually be...
You need to predict also how it, well it interacts with matter.
Exactly, depending on the coupling. There's two
yeah.
parameter space.
Yeah.
There is the mass and the coupling, right? So in principle, it can be more sensitive at atomic clocks. If you look at the, let's say, variations that go above 100 seconds, slower than 100 seconds, they can be better than equivalence principle test. Because these forces, these coupling
well,
are the same
yeah,
order of
coupling. Let me solve all the problems. Do this, and there is no equivalence. Good principle test constraints.
No, of course, but
that's
then
it.
It's
so
a,
there are many portals you can take as interactions, right? So there's like, but there is you know a parameter space to fill.
Can we had a small side conversation over here, and I'd love to hear what other people have to say. But let's take seriously a time varying alpha that has some constant value. And then a very rapidly fluctuating. So, wouldn't you don't need an atomic clock to see it? But does everyone agree that that would be frequency modulation on all spectra?
That's
yeah.
that's correct.
Yeah.
And so, but so what? So forget about almost then you don't care about omega. You can scan over many terahertz to go look for the sidebands. But now, what is the delta alpha? What's the depth of modulation?
Yeah, you can estimate, right?
Well,
depending on the coupling.
Right now, I put it on the log-log scale, right? So if I take it order one, it's not going to work, right? It's grossly excluded by many things, right? And it's just a question of figuring out the sensitivity. It's a sensible question, right?
You can, I mean...
So far, all the limits, in some sense, are quoted in the expansion of this in small omega, right? And you can the limits are quoted on delta alpha times this factor, right? So somewhere there, there will be limits on that.
Unfortunately, the power in the sideband is the square
right.
of that.
But so it's
very
also
small. So
which is how small is it?
One
no,
stroke interference or
yeah.
something.
So you can estimate it from the dark matter abundant.
Exactly,
okay.
But
so if you assume that the particle is dark matter abundant, you know that this amplitude of oscillation is set by. So if you assume dark matter, so this is the equation that you need to use, and then you can multiply it with the fraction of dark matter. So this amplitude of oscillation tells you, if you assume it's dark matter, it's 0.3 joules per centimeter squared, tells you how much this amplitude of oscillation is because it goes like this, okay? So, and as you can see now, the amplitude of oscillation goes down as the mass increases. So that's why it gets harder to look at larger frequencies, you would expect more natural things to occur. The other thing is that, yeah, and the frequency of oscillation is again, this omega is just the mass of the particle.
So is it actually dark matter or dark energy?
Dark energy does not oscillate. Dark energy effectively has to be a field that just is constant with time or slowly shifts
Dark
energy is this parameter
yes.
would have to be,
yeah.
right?
So we're talking
except
about
if it's
masses,
the wall boundary.
So we're talking about masses that are much heavier than the Hubble scale.
But aren't there some theories about this 10 to 12 hertz for dark energy also?
No. Well, I shouldn't say. I don't know. No, for that you could have well. I don't know of any concrete, I mean, Ramat has thought about this more than I have. I mean, you could have, if someone comes up with a theory, you could have as byproducts of whatever explains the dark energy component, which you know, basically the dark energy component should behave like a cosmological constant. So it should be some field that's slowly varying with time. So this type of field would not explain directly what the dark energy is, but it could be a dark prime product of the overall theory because you get some
varying. Isn't it sort of one of the theories suggested to explain 120 orders of magnitude?
No, I don't know of any theory that has.
Look, as I'll say tomorrow, we're short on theory. There are sort of, in any sort of concrete, really concrete sense, that, for example, the theories of axions and so on that are being talked about now are very well worked out. By that standard, the theories of dark energy that are not just a cosmological constant are
but isn't it
very vague.
Yeah.
And in fact,
but there is this kind of this huge inconsistency, this 100 orders.
There is a huge inconsistency. It's not an inconsistency. It's a naturalist problem of exactly the kind that, from the way we've been taught to think as field theorists and people trying to understand everything but gravity.
Is this sort of time dependent?
Not necessarily. No. This
only
be,
the cures.
This is,
there is something that many of you would consider a kind of aesthetic problem. And for those of us who know field theory and have looked at how it works in condensed matter physics, we think of it as a harder problem. But that problem by itself, if you can just fine-tune the parameters of your model and fit the data, and you don't have a time-dependent anything. If you try to solve the fine-tuning problem, if you say, I don't like to fine-tune my parameters, at least the way theorists think about it, then you put in a solution for this fine-tuning problem, and it may give rise to your time-dependent couplings and so on. I say may because we do not have an example of that that is extremely well worked out for the real-world dark energy problem. It doesn't exist. Now, we have things that are similar, for example, you can say the electroweak hierarchy problem is, to field theorists, a kind of a toy model of some aspects of the cosmological constant problem. There we actually have solutions. And those solutions involve to the fine-tuning problem. And they involve new particles, new physics. If you take it into the dark matter regime, that new particles, new physics, may in fact give you things like time-varying alpha and so on. But we don't know for sure because we do not have these tightly worked models, as I'll discuss tomorrow. What we have are perhaps some directions that you can go fishing. But we are now talking about a fishing expedition where we don't know what fish we're catching. Right? So it's a different thing from saying, here's the QCD axion. It's incredibly challenging, but I know what fish it is. And I'm gonna aim for that. So there's I consider the excitement of this workshop is there are two directions. There's what I'll call conservative physics in incredibly challenging waters, right? Think axion. And then I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't even know whether relativity is right, whether quantum mechanics is right. But we have unprecedented improvements in our ability to probe the world, okay? And let's try go fishing and see whether something breaks in what we consider conservative. So I think there are two strands of thought, and one should not muddy the other. You know, so on the one hand, my conservative thinking, like Mina's, is you talk about these time-varying alphas. It's so unnatural. All the ways I've been taught to think, like every theorist in this room, is that's a long shot. That's such a long shot, I'm not wasting any more time. I'm not coming to the workshop. But there's the other half, which is the, well, where has that got you so far? And that tells you, you know, try it. Okay, I mean, so that's the bimodal nature of this case.
Any other? By the way, do you want to make an announcement now before, and then we can ask more questions or people can go to the
So this has nothing to do with this science, okay? So this has everything to do with people in science, yeah? So. So I just,
young people.
Mike actually might be a member of the work committee and okay, anyways, and now I'm getting emails that the deadline is soon. Okay, so and basically this is an announcement of this award. So the deadline is July 1st. So this is for young outstanding researchers in this community. Okay, so you should notice that the PhD degree should not be earned more than 18 years prior to the nomination deadline. So nomination deadline is July 1st, and any members of the selection committee could accept nominations. There is also, if you go to the APS, the website of the American Physical Society, there is a link where you go submit nominations, and it also spells out what supporting materials are required. Okay? Okay.
Mike, are you a winner of this?
Oh, it wasn't so good,
yeah. Yeah, so we have a winner already.
We already have a winner.
So does anyone else have any other comments? So we're done for the day. Everyone's ready to go eat?